Hi, everyone. My name is Kirk Bachman, and welcome back to The Ultimate Dish. Today, I'm speaking with James Porter, an Arizona-born chef and business owner of Terra Farm and Manor, a combined restaurant, inn, rustic farm, and cooking school located in the Prescott National Forest. With a 33-plus-year career in the hospitality industry, including private clubs and boutique hotels, James is nothing short of a creative visionary. He has received dozens of awards and accolades for innovative cuisine, including Edible Phoenix 2009, Hero Award, Best New Restaurants 2010, Phoenix Magazine, just to name a few. We'll get to more in just a moment. At Terra, he's dedicated to employing sound principles, culinary principles that directly support local businesses, farmers, and ranchers. Chef Porter always presents guests with fresh, innovative menu ideas that still remain nostalgic. Join me today as I chat with Chef Porter about how he built his own food mecca from the ground up, his transition from apprentice to culinary risk taker, and his philosophies around cuisine. And there he is. You got to smile when you see this guy. How are you?
I'm doing good, Chef. Thank you. That was very kind.
Very nice to see you. And we just, as we were chatting before we got started, we kind of both realized we've run into each other. Chefs kind of do that, you know, throughout history. But before, I got to set the stage. You said one of the funniest things when we were just chatting a little bit. You're in the beautiful state of Arizona. I've longed for Arizona for many years. So you're shoveling sunshine today, right? As we speak,
looking out of my office window, and I think it's a little bluebird sky today. So I apologize. That's a little frightening for you.
Oh, it is. Well, yesterday was 7 below, and I got 2 frozen pipes. And today it's warming up to 3 degrees in beautiful Boulder, Colorado.
Hey, we all have choices.
You're not making me feel any better about it. But hey, we're going to have some fun today. You know, you're one of those superstars in the beautiful state of Arizona. We have a lot of people in common, Chef Bo McMillan, John Paul Hutchins, Chef Lee Moore. And we're so, so honored that Bo kind of tapped us on the shoulder and said, you got to talk to this guy. What is it about the camaraderie among your group, let's just call it Arizona chefs, that number one makes it so special to be there? Number two, that it makes it special to dine there?
Well, first of all, I mean, we're just good friends. We've gone on vacation together. I'm leaving in 24 hours with Bo to go to a Naples Food and Wine. I'm sponsoring a beef. I'm sponsoring a beef, the beef with the Wagyu beef for his entree at a dinner that we're doing together. And then we're raffling off a big charity event out at our farm. I think it's the unique combination of a bunch of guys and there's some gals in the mix somewhere that truly are just at a state in their career that started at a very, you know, certain point of their career that have realized that the power comes in collaboration and the power comes in knowledge, mentoring, and working with each other. We've all grinded. We've all done and had amazing accolades. And now, interworkingly, we are businessmen working together for the greater of the good. And I got to tell you, it is, there's not a day that goes by that's not exciting when you get to interact with guys. Look, guys like Bo. Lee is a super great friend. John Paul Hutchins, we just connect, you know, he was my basics instructor in culinary school.
I love John Paul. You got to give me at least one John Paul story from way back in the day.
Well, I wasn't a very good student, and thank God we had a common like for the Grateful Dead. And so he put up with my shenanigans, and I was a visual thinker. And I remember him explaining how to, you know, flip an omelet in a pan and flip things in a pan. And I remember we stuck button mushrooms in a saute pan. And at that time, you know, in culinary school, a lot of us already had experience. Yeah. So we kind of knew these things, and it almost was a refinement for us. But we got down on the ground, and John Paul was explaining to us on how to flip an omelet in a pan through a acrobatic cartwheel movement that we were all having to do on the ground. And I was like, you know what? I like this guy. I can work. Like, he can work with me, and I can work with him. This is going to go well.
Isn't it amazing, though, how you, and this is a true story. I was teaching, you know, early in the 90s at a small culinary school in the Northwest. And, you know, my first class, which probably had 13 people in it, 2 of those chefs are still in contact with me today. You know, one's in Austin, Texas, and one One is actually out on the East Coast.
The guy that was on the East Coast, would this culinary school happen to be in near like Washington or Oregon, in one of those perhaps states?
Yeah. Portland, Oregon. Yeah.
And I helped open that new campus. I remember hanging out at the caviar station at the grand opening of that culinary school as a guest.
No way. I mean, what are the chances? What that must have been, what, 2000?
2001.
Unbelievable. Now it kind of makes sense. But the whole idea of, you know, I've got four kids, and, you know, the conversations we have are about, you know, going to school, regardless of where you go to school. It's also about the experience. It's about the culture. It's about getting to know people. And it's different today, right? Because education has changed. The internet has changed a lot of different things. But I'm here every single day. And what's most important to me is that people are respectful to each other and they develop cool relationships with each other. Because you never know, you know, when Bo's going to call.
You never know.
Right? You never know. But you know what? Let's talk about you. I am absolutely, you know, I'm fascinated. I'm going to embarrass you a little bit. You did an amazing apprenticeship after culinary school when apprenticeships were very popular, and we're seeing those coming back, right? My father, for the record, is a master pastry chef, came from Germany in the 60s, but that's the only life he knew, right? Apprenticeship. And you had the honor of working at the Greenbrier. And you don't even have to say anything. You just say Greenbrier. Everyone knows it's the Greenbrier, right? We'll talk about butchering 30 legs of lamb in a minute, but very, very respectfully, I had the great privilege of knowing Master Chef Peter Timmons. Amazing human being. And when you think about the list, Chef, of alumni, right? Richard Rosendale, Michael Voltaggio, Todd Warner, yeah. Amy Mills, Stephen Gustar, Jared Miller, Aaron, the list goes on, and you. I'm sure it was rigorous, but I've got a little.
Are you getting goosebumps? Honestly, it was a great point in food. It was a great point in or a time in education, I think, for me. And it was an opportunity to dive into something raw and run at 150 miles an hour for about 3 years. And I don't regret an ounce of it. And the respect and the relationships that we have within the alumni is quite amazing. And there's not one of those guys from either the class that I was in or classes 25, 50 years prior to my class that if you picked up the phone and said, "Hey, chef, I need you here. I'm doing an event and I only want to work with, you know, Greenbrier grad," that person would be there in a heartbeat. It is a bond. It's an unbreakable bond.
Yeah. And we talked about it earlier. Richard Rosendale, certified master chef, was
animal.
He's been on the show. He's an incredible professional. How did that all come about? How did you end up at the Greenbrier? Because you were in Arizona, right?
I was. You know, I graduated from culinary school, and one of our other instructors in the class, you know, he's like, he was an Austrian guy, and he was like, you know, I'm like, "So now what, chef?" He's like, "Well, you pack your bags."
Yeah.
And I said, "Okay," we packed our bags. So I went to Ginny Lake Lodge in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Oh. And at the time, Ginny Lake was owned and operated by the Greenbrier Resort Management Company. And then I got a call one day from Walter Scheib.
No. Wow. Yeah, and
it was kind of embarrassing because I was a cocky young guy. And I remember being in the kitchen. I was working with Paul Ramsey, was my chef at the time, whose father was a pastry chef at the Woodstock Inn for a long time. But Paul had been an apprentice at one point and was a chef at the Greenbrier, and kind of said, "Hey, you know what, maybe this is a good guy." And so Scheib called and said, "Hey, would you like to apply?" You know, and I was like, "Oh, apply? What is this? You know, how does this work?" Well, you know, so I applied. And then I went down to work for CSX at the Boca Bay Pass Club in Boca Grande, Florida, also owned by the Greenbrier. And then I went back to Ginny Lake, and then they were like, "Okay, after your next season, you'll be ready. We want you to come up to the Greenbrier and be an apprentice." So it was me and the seven guys, and we had a junior class, and we were the senior class, or, you know, juniors and seniors. Rich, I believe at the time, was our junior, but he could have taught the class probably at that point. I mean, he's a special human.
Yeah, I just love the stories. One additional thing, I have a little journal that I've carried around over the years. And this was years ago. Peter simply said, best wishes from the culinary brigade at the Greenbrier, Peter Timmons.
Huh.
Good memories, huh? Good memories.
Great. Yeah. You know, the words that I remember, and you know, without getting choked up about it, the words that I always remember is be aggressive in your own rescue. Be aggressive in your own rescue. And he would sometimes yell that at us or simply lean over and grab you by your collar on your coat and pull you in real tight and close. And he would say, Seamus, be aggressive in your own rescue. And then he would put back, and then, you know, have to get your ass kicked throughout the night. You'd maybe, you know, meet down at the local tavern and have a gin and tonic or something. And if he sat with you, you're like, and that was, you know, that was then. And there was it was a small group in, you know, in West Virginia. So we'd go out when we were had a moment to breathe. But he was special, and he was a teacher, and he was a mentor, and he was a friend, and he was an instructor. And some guys worked with him a lot longer than I did, and some worked less. But the amount of knowledge that he poured into what we would do and instilled, and when you thought you were about ready to break, he would push the gas pedal down 10 more percent, 20 more percent, literally until those wheels were wobbling. And then he would wait, and he'd kind of look at you, he'd wink, and then he would jump in with you, and he would help you, and he would swim with you, and he would run with you. And it was incredible. And when you hit that rev limit, where you're like, I have been cooking at 100 miles an hour for the last 6 hours. I've sweated out 5 gallons of water. I can't put enough fluids in me. I'm literally sopping wet on a brigade of 16 chefs cooking, you know, 175 a la carte meals myself, or whatever the number was on our scoreboard. That was the big thing back then, the scoreboard. He would jump in, and he would be your wingman at that point, and you would give him instructions. Chef, I need this. Chef, I need that. And he would, it was a surgical dance, and you would hold your hand out, and then something would go right into it. So, I mean, it was a magical moment in my life.
Now I'm getting all chilled. I mean, those are unbelievable memories. Leading by example by you, not behind or in front of you. Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely. 100%. Love that. That reminds me, we started to talk a little bit about this gentleman right here. Maybe not as eloquent, right? But nonetheless, a leader, right?
A massive leader. You know, I remember that book came out. Not a lot of people knew who Marco Pierre White was. Actually, I remember getting one of my first Marco Pierre White books at the Greenbrier with another friend of ours, Peter Schittler, who had worked for Peter Timmons in Ireland and had traveled around and worked at the Baltimore Country Club. And nevertheless, and once you open up the first few chapters of White Heat, if you had grew up in that era of cooking, then it completely made sense. If you did not grow up in that era, you're thinking, geez, have I picked the wrong career? And if you grew up any time recently, you're like, how does that happen? And I was sitting in my first restaurant, Topino Kitchen and Wine Bar, circa 2004. And heard that Marco Pierre was coming to Washington, to the Pacific Northwest, to do a book signing tour. And I forget the darling chef up there at the time that had a bunch of restaurants. So I called this restaurant after service one night. It was about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. And I had a few, you know, I was cleaning the kitchen up and getting ready to go home and had a couple glasses of wine in me. So I called the chef. I said, hey, listen, chef, I've got a restaurant down in Arizona. I heard that Marco was coming to town. And he's like, yeah, he's sold out. And I'm like, oh, man, you know, one of the greatest guys that I've always wanted to see, Marco Pierre White. You know, that'd be great to hang out with him. He's like, chef, just come up. Don't worry about a thing. Get on a plane and come up. So I booked a red eye, flew up 2 days later. I landed at 7 o'clock in the morning and literally did a posse tasting around town for about 9 hours before I got to the dinner. Arrived at the dinner and walk in, and there's Marco. And, you know, he's a big guy, and he's got that aura and presence and kind of F you about him that is just like cool. And he looked at me and he goes, oh, so you're the bloke that flew in, huh? And I said, yeah, chef. And he goes, sit right here. So I sat right down next to Marco. We had dinner together, but he signed my book. It says he flew in MPW. And then at the end of the night, he's like, hey boys, how about we go around town and eat? So we literally roamed around Seattle, Washington to about sunrise in the morning to the fish market with Marco Pierre, eating, drinking, smoking. Like, I mean, it was an absolute epic time. And he was the most gracious human in the world. gracious human in the world, talking about his studies and was never braggadocious, never got into whatever, just talked about foundation.
Yeah.
And that was great.
Yeah. I just love it. You said something about the gracious state of Washington chef, Terry. Chef Terry used to wear a beautiful top hat. No.
I want to say Mark or Matt. He had like four or five restaurants in about 2004 or 2005. He won kind of best chef of that area.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was a nice guy too.
Super, super quick story about this. So this is actually a menu. I was in Dublin with my wife for her birthday, and we were walking around, and I was telling her similar stories. I was telling her about Marco Pierre White.
Yeah, and they're hard to believe.
And we're walking down the street, and I look across the street, and it's like I'd seen a ghost. Marco Pierre White Steakhouse had just opened up. Literally, it couldn't have been more serendipitous. I didn't know that. And so we couldn't get in that night, but we got in the next night. He wasn't there, but they gave me the menu, and it was spectacular. As if he was there.
He has an aura. Just like, you know, guys of that time, you look at Pierre Kaufman, the Rue Brothers.
Yeah.
Guys that really set generations up for success. Look at Hartman Hanke. Herman Rusch.
Oh, God. The names. I'm getting chills. I love this.
It was my winter off of my apprenticeship. And we were in a room and we were doing our platter judging right before our last platter judging before we went away for kind of our fall for a couple months. And Timmons looked at me, and I had been working in the Virgin Islands and down in St. John. And I wanted to do this goat platter. So I was taking it to the next extreme out at one of the butcher's house. I was raising a goat because I wanted to slaughter this goat for the platter, which everybody was like, that's next level. That's next level. And I'm like, we're going to slaughter this goat. And Hartman was one of our, you know, coaches, and Lawrence McFadden and Johnny Johnstone. And, you know, these guys would come and judge our stuff. And we sat down for our platter, and Peter, the whole year, he looked at me. He's like, Seamus, nobody eats goat. Nobody eats goat. And he was dogging me on this platter. And then in the final judging, Hartman was in there, and he looked at me, and he's like, in his accent, and he said something to the effect of, I'm glad you did something other than the normal stuff like lamb or beef or pork. And he goes, goat really impresses me. And I just remember kind of looking at Peter going like this. And he nodded. And that was the joke, is Porter's goat platter. The whole time. And I think that there was a little twinkle in Peter's eye for a second of, okay, you got me.
You gotcha. Gotcha. But humble enough to be able to admit that. I love the names. John Johnstone. Oh my gosh. He was at the Broadmoor for a while. Lawrence McFadden. I mean, is there a better talent?
The Duquesne's Club. I mean, the Duquesne's Club was, you know,
pumping them out. Yeah.
When people look at what Charlie Trotter was doing years in life, that was great. But there was guys like Lawrence McFadden that were doing it years before.
Before, yeah.
And just like setting, you know, when they, you know, everything that we did during our apprenticeship kind of revolved around obviously technique, execution, and stamina. But we also trained and practiced for the, you know, to help assist, you know, Mark Lambertini and these guys going to the, you know, the Culinary Olympics in Knocknurst in Germany. So it was a training thing.
Let's talk a little bit about how your career then progressed, and then we'll get to Tara. But
yeah.
I mean, you've shared some of the names. You've worked at a dozen resorts and then, you know, ended up in Arizona. Petite Maison, I'd love to hear you. You're already smiling. I love the name. Let's talk about that a little bit, and then we'll jump into Tara.
Well, my first dip into the restaurant business, actually, I was trying to open up a restaurant right next to Greg Higgins up on the South Park blocks in the old Machismo Mouse space that was
I know Greg. Wow.
And I was trying to open up a restaurant up there and realized that I just didn't know anybody, couldn't get any capital, moved back to Arizona. I remember laying in bed, somebody FedExed me the lease, didn't even read it, just turned the last page, signed the last page, put the lease in the FedEx envelope, sent it back, and started my first restaurant, Topino Kitchen and Wine Bar. 50 wines by the glass, global tapas. It was cutting edge. I think everything in that restaurant was something that I could look back now and go, wow. You know, we were early to the game on some things. And, you know, 6 years later in 2008, I went bankrupt. I lost everything that I had. Bankrupt. gone. It was during the financial crisis, and it was, you know, quite honestly, it was a bad business model on my part as a chef, but it was hell fun, and we had a blast, and we poured Chateau et Kim by the glass, and, you know, wines that nobody's got any common sense to do, because I just wanted to, like, get and expose people to some really cool stuff. My resurgence as a Phoenician was, you know, the Phoenician will rise again. And I found this old beat up adobe building in downtown Scottsdale. And we opened up Petit Maison, classic French bistro. My two best friends, you know, two good buddies of mine, both Matt Carter and Christopher Gross, owned and have French restaurants. And I was like, you know, I want to do something very, a little bit different than what they do. And we all, and they're all very geographically spread apart. It was great. It had 8 seats at the bar, 20 seats inside, 60 seats out on the patio. We cranked out numbers. We worked in a space that was probably the size of your office with 2 stoves that I got from Le Cordon Culinary School when they did their capital expense remodel. Somebody called me and was like, hey, you want to buy some equipment? I'm like, God, it's probably been cleaned 1,000 times. This shit is spotless. I said, how's $250 a stove? And they're like, come and get them.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
And I thought, well, how apropos is that? And it was great. And then in 2014, walked in, made an offer. And usually the only way to make money in the restaurant business is burn it down or sell it. And I've been tempted. But so I took the sell part. Moved to Wisconsin with an old GM from the Biltmore in Miami, opened up and did some hotel consulting for a few years. And during that time kind of started what is, you know, kind of now this mecca, you know, Disneyland of some cool stuff we're working on.
Before we jump into that, I'm just curious if you don't mind sharing. So you went from sort of the pinnacle of culinary training, an apprenticeship, you went to culinary school, but an apprenticeship at the Greenbrier. I mean, that's about as 90 degree as you get. This is how it was. And then you became a risk taker. So talk about that a little bit.
In between that, you know, I'd left the Greenbrier. I remember we did our final show presentation. You stay up for like 5 days. I could show you pictures and it looked like I was, you know, living on the streets of Seattle, but it was due to no sleep. I mean, you would literally go 3 days without sleep and still operate at 100%.
Yeah, yeah.
When you had sleep, you're at least at 110, 120. And my first chef job was at the Arizona Biltmore. And I moved out here. And I remember I was working with a guy, the executive chef, Jeffrey Cousineau. And a super great guy. And I said, listen, I don't care what you pay me. I honestly don't care what you pay me, because I will outwork every single human in this hotel and I will outperform every single human in this hotel. Give me 30 days and you will see an instantaneous return on it. And at day 31, they called me up into the office and they're like, we're not looking for an interim chef anymore. We know that we've got our chef here. And I said, well, of course you do. And so they brought me on. From there, I went and worked for Steve Wynn and opened up the Beau Rivage Casino. Brought in a whole bunch of Greenbrier alumni to help me open up that. Some are still down there. But, you know, then you get to a point. Then I ended up back down at the Biltmore in Miami and working down there in the early 2000s in California during the 99. But quick stint in New Jersey with great chef Tony Wall for the Grand Hyatt New York. Opened up his own place and a bunch of guys wouldn't help him open it up. But I remember the moment I was sitting in Miami and I was on Telemundo television. And if you know anything about Telemundo, it's definitely not English speaking television. And I was giving it my all. I was hacking through, you know, the best Spanglish chef speak kitchen talk that I could get down, and in between that they were bleeping the words, so I don't know if people thought I was cussing or if they thought I was just really bad at speaking Spanish, but it worked. And I took a restaurant that was a kind of a unique concept at the time, a big exhibition kitchen, and grew it to, you know, $2.5 million in about a year from about $1 million. And I thought to myself, you know what? I can work like this. I can work. The Greenbrier has prepared me for the mental, you know, the mental strain of what comes at you. I'll do a 90-hour work week, no problem. That doesn't bother me. And I went to the ownership. I said, listen, I've made you some cash. Would you like to invest in me or I've got to go? And they're like, listen, we would. And I said, well, I'm going to Portland, Oregon. And they're like, Portland, Oregon. And I said, yeah. And I said, yeah, I found a gal. I'm going to Portland, Oregon, and I'm going to go open a restaurant. So I moved there, and they didn't want to do anything. And I grounded out there for about a year, trying all sorts of fun stuff. And then I was like, you know what? I just remember being there, and I was trying to open up a restaurant at the South Park Blocks, right there at that Machismo Mouse.
Yeah, yeah.
And I couldn't get anything going. And then finally, I just woke up. I found a spot online in Arizona. I'm like, send me the lease. And I honestly, Kirk, I didn't even read the lease. I opened it up, signed my name, did a personal guarantee, shipped it back. And I was like, here we go.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love the just authentic enthusiasm. That's what defines you. I could just sit here and listen to you talk for hours. Let's talk about Terra. And I have to set the stage, right? Everybody's got this dream, right? I was telling you before we got on that, you know, my wife gets on me a lot because we live in Boulder, Colorado. And when we get away, I like to go to Jackson Hole. I like to go to Montana. I like to go to Central Oregon. I like to go to Arizona. What you have built here, and we'll let you do this in your words, but Terra Farm and Manor, it's a chef's dream. Hell, it's anyone's dream, right? And, big ranch, chef orchestrated meals and beverages and interactive farm activities. When I look, it's a farm / ranch. I mean, I'm seeing horses. And I mean, my 12-year-old boy, Joseph Henry, dreams. I showed him your website and he was just like, let's go, Dad.
We are accepting applications for young apprentices.
He's a tough kid. Was this all-inclusive sort of resort idea always brewing for you? I mean, it's fascinating. You come to us and you don't need any, park your car because we'll take care of the rest.
Yeah. So you fast forward a little bit, backpedal a little bit. I had sold the restaurant, Petit Maison, and moved to Wisconsin. And literally right before I had left, a gentleman that I had some interaction with walked in and was like, hey, you know, I got your number from not only the culinary school across the street, which was Le Cordon Bleu, but, you know, a mutual relative. And he's like, I want to meet with you and talk to you about something I got going. And he came and he's like, listen, take a ride with me. Let's go up to Prescott. I want to show you something. So we got in the car. We drove up to Prescott and he showed me this property. And he is my current business partner. And he drove me up to this ranch property that was kind of half done, half not done. And was like, you got any ideas what we could do with this? And I just almost had an aneurysm. And like, ideas. And he's like, and he's a good mentor. We're business partners in this. And he's kind of given me the ability to be able to do something as wacky and as crazy as that, because I think he's as wacky, as crazy as I am. He just, you know, he's a numbers guy and I'm a creative guy. And we met in the middle and he mentors me on my kind of my business acumen and the things that I want to learn. As chefs, when you get into this, you're not a business person. You don't know it. So you make a lot of financial mistakes. That's why you make no money. And then you finally quickly realize that, oh, if we tweak it and I learn a little bit, we can do better. So he'd asked me, he's like, what do you think you do for it? And I said, listen, whatever we do, I made a handshake deal with a previous friend of mine to go open a project up in Wisconsin. And I got to put that. And he's like, whenever you're ready, you let me know. And the moment you're ready to do something, we'll do it. I was up there 6 months, came back and kind of reversed where I was living in consulting and started the project. And selfishly, everything is designed around me. It is designed wholeheartedly for every ounce of sweat that I've put into this career my entire life. It's everything that I want out of it. It's everything that if you were at you, it's a chef's place to go. And if you were sitting there, you'd be like, ah, a little menu RDs, a little moist towel to wipe my hands. Oh, look, there's a little lemon bowl to soak my fingers in after eating the shrimp cocktail. Somebody's parked my car. They vacuumed it. They've done every little detail from a chef's perspective, diving into it and then being able to execute it and then charge people accordingly.
Well, and so as you walk around and, you know, I want our listeners to understand the experience. You said something very important from the chef's perspective, because the chef, the restaurateur, the entrepreneur, the hospitality person sees this all day long. Curtis Duffy told me one time, you know, his restaurant in Chicago ever. And when you walk up, it's smack dab in the middle of Chicago, but his 30 feet by 5 feet sidewalk in front of his restaurant is spotless. spotless by design, so that when you step out of your vehicle, you're about to enter an experience. And I just love that you said that. And you know, walk me through, like, when you wrap up, you can tell I'm excited about it. When you wrap up the evening, right? And you're walking the grounds, you're walking the kitchen. Is it just constant? Oh, starting tomorrow, we're going to do this. I'm going to get new golf carts that are designed after vehicles for guests to take from the restaurant. It's crazy, well, right?
It is. I mean, a lot of that creative process sits around with my partner, and I get the creative avenue, but, you know, I mean, he's definitely my support in it, and kind of that tapping on the shoulder of, okay, let's dabble in this, let's play in this and go for it and try it. And again, as business people, you get a lot of hesitance and scared. Well, if you can take that out and you can have somebody that can help manage that piece for you, that it actually allows you to do what you are good at doing. And that's what I'm good at doing. And, you know, my nights out there usually wrap up with the clients and the guests around the campfire, sipping a scotch, drinking a glass of wine, smoking a cigar, talking about experiences and listening to where they've traveled and what's going on, so that if there's any key things that they talk about, I can easily shift and manipulate. And, oh, you know what? You lived in Nantucket. Let's do this. You know, I can incorporate some of our farming practices in there. But generally, all of the decisions as a diner and as guests have been made for you prior to ever coming on that property. We do preference sheets. We do these dossiers that ask you a gazillion questions. And then some questions just to throw you off, like your astrological sign. I don't know. I just want to know who I'm. I want to know who I'm
who am I serving?
Out with. Yeah, who's out here? But kind of taking it, you know, and it's not that we're sitting down for meals that are 100 courses and everything is authentic. Everything is made out there. I mean, quote, the farm to table. I mean, it's a radio call away and I have a vegetable out of the ground and into the kitchen in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That's the level of freshness that I want it to be in.
But you've worked your entire career to get to that, right? Taking mental notes. Yeah. Yeah.
It is. It is those mental notes. You know, the Ritz-Carlton, I used to, you know, this was at the Greenbrier, it was ladies and gentlemen being served by ladies and gentlemen. That was the motto. And later on, you could reference the Hillstone Group. If you were to eat at a Hillstone restaurant in Kentucky and go to one in California, they'd be doing lineup at the same time. They'd be serving the same cream spinach. It was like it was a mechanical machine. And if you called the Ritz-Carlton in Calcutta, India, it'd be under 3 rings that somebody would pick up. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. How may I help you? We're the service industry.
I love it. I love it. That's TikTok right there, by the way. You have a market at Terra as well, right?
We do. We started, you know, the market kind of came about from, I was thinking, hey, let's get some fancy pigs. Let's get some fancy beef. And then, you know, just as crazy as I am on the food side, my partner was like, okay. And then he called me and he's like, hey, I found a herd. We're going to buy a herd in Portugal, and I'm sending a guy over there, and he's going to go hand select different bloodlines of these pigs in Portugal, and we're shipping them back to the U.S. It'll take about 8 months. And I was like, Jesus Christ, I just wanted, I needed two pigs. I needed two pigs. Now, 1,000 pigs later, a charcuterie business who I get help with, a great chef up in your area, Justin Brunson. That used to own River Bear Meats and, you know, a little charcuterie up there. And then we started with the Wagyu beef as well. And now we raise about 1,000 head of 100% tajimi Wagyu Japanese beef on about 200,000 acres.
I just love it. You know what I love about the market concept? It's that opportunity for a guest to take a little bit of you with them, right? Whether they put it on their counter, in their fridge, in their bellies, whatever it is, right? Really good friend of mine and the school, Farmer Lee Jones. He's got a beautiful place in Ohio called the Chef's
Lee
Garden.
Lee is a dear, good friend. I was just on the phone with him not too long ago. A friend of ours had passed away at a funeral, and I was on the East Coast, and Lee called me. And it was a group of chefs sitting around kind of mourning and celebrating life. And Lee called me on the phone. He goes, I got a couple stories to tell you. That 1 year, Tony was so goddamn busy, he told me to, quote, pack up a Christmas tree, decorate it, and ship it to me. And he goes, I had a couple Christmas trees growing out on the property. So I packed it up, I decorated it, sent it to the Grand Hyatt, New York. And all he had to do was take it out of the box and plug it in, and it was fresh. But Lee is an absolute gentleman. Brilliant guy.
I'm gonna start crying. Yeah, he is that. And a great friend, not only to the school, but my family. I took my 12-year-old boy there in October, and he just had the time of his life. The reason I brought up the market is that he's got his 400 acres there. But the heartbeat is the market, which, you know, burned down a year ago and then they rebuilt it. Beautiful community there. But the market is amazing and it's packed. And, you know, it's Milan, Ohio, you know, not a huge population outside of Cleveland, but the market draws people in. I love that. I love that aspect about it.
I remember getting catalogs from Lee in the early days. They weren't even catalogs. They were Xerox sheets of pictures. And you knew that you had gotten, like, I remember back in the day when I was in California, I was like, I'm going to order from the chef's garden out here. I'm going to serve stuff from the chef's garden. And I'd spent a lot of money with Lee when we opened up the casino in Biloxi, the Beau Rivage in Biloxi. We spent, you know, we'd spend about 10 grand a week with Lee. So when I opened up, he flooded me with just piles of stuff. He's like, don't worry about it. It was great. He is a pioneer farmer for this country.
Unbelievable. And is, you know, the Culinary Vegetable Institute and the team, the 75 people that work for him are in line. Culture is there. It's a community of service. I absolutely love it. Let's talk a little bit about your approach to, you know, food philosophies at Terra. You know, the sustainability, the local sourcing, your collaboration with local ranchers, you know, your inspiration from day to day. I love this topic.
It's cool. So I've been working a lot with the University of Arizona in Tucson. With a couple of their professors down there. And the reason I bring that up is we talk about wellness. You know, we talk about wellness in this industry a lot for a host of reasons, just because of what this industry is. And I think we've all seen results of pros and cons of what it can do and can't do. And the best thing to do is navigate down the middle of it and do the best you can. But when you talk about wellness, there's mental wellness, there's physical wellness, and then there's, you know, these things that you put into your body and the wellness of the animal. So our practices are very regenerative that we do on property. I mean, the whole property itself is self-sustainable. It's all solar powered. There's not an ounce of electricity that comes from the outside sources. It's all generated on property. The animals that we raise are all heritage breeds of animals, so they're not overgrown. They take their time. They like the long walks in the evening, strolls through the, you know, the meadows to eat versus being, you know, caged up in any sorts of pens. So the inspiration, after I was chatting with one of the professors down there that we're working on some projects together, is, you know, whole wellness. And what does that mean to me? What it means to me is that, A, I get to work with great ingredients. And I remember early on of, you know, you would take a carrot and you would manipulate it and you would have to do this and do that to it and do 42 things to it and add it to it. And now as I get older and maybe lazier, possibly, I don't know, or just smarter to some degree, is how about we just take a carrot that today the Brix levels in it are the perfect sugar content, and we're going to pluck it right now and we're going to go eat it in the next 15 minutes. Nobody can do that. Not many people can do that. You know, Farmer Lee can, and Wade on their property, they can get away with doing that. And I know Lee would be singing these praises as well. There's a difference. And his is a business. Mine is a business. I don't sell vegetables. So I may grow a row of 50 items. And if I feed 49 of them to the animals because they're not perfect, oh well. But for me, it's going out there and finding the best tasting one out of that whole bunch and going, perfect. Salted water, a little bit of this, a little vinegar, whatever it might be, serving the food. So the simplicity in the cuisine, the authenticity in the cuisine, and you know, it may have been John Paul. I don't know who it was, but we were talking about cuisine at one point, not calling it confusion. It's not fusion or confusion. Just let it be. And now that we're raising tajimi wagyu beef, some of the best beef in the world, all you want on it is a little salt, a little pepper, and just cook it correctly. Yeah. Actually, that's all that I ever put on the food. I don't even put sauces on stuff anymore. Maybe a little olive oil, the pig, whatever it is. So the inspiration that I have when I'm out there is the ability to go, wow, here's another angle of looking at our industry, folks. Here's another angle of doing it. Now, Does it work on a large scale for stuff? It's tough. It can be tough. I know they did it at the Greenbrier. Rich started a whole farm at the Greenbrier. So they were able to do that. But for me, kind of walking around on that property, what makes me happy is the ability to realize that I'm serving the best food at the best time. It may not be manipulated the best. I mean, it may not look like what we just saw last weekend at Bocuse d'Or, but that's not what I'm going for. That's not what I want to do.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I love it. The whole time I'm listening to you, I'm also thinking about what I'm going to say next. And you've got this, so it's a super cool vibe there in Arizona. You know, a local guy here, you've probably heard of Bobby Stuckey, right? You know, just the...
Bobby's an Arizona boy.
He's an Arizona boy, right? Northern Arizona. And good friend of the school, really good friend of the school. So a lot of people I speak with, Bobby's a runner. Going to speak with Brian Dalton in a couple of weeks. He's got a few restaurants here. He's an ultra marathoner. Curtis Duffy's, you know, a music and motorcycle guy. Which is it for you? Music? John Paul, come on. Go on.
No, so I'm a big music fan. So you're asking me the question is when I'm not working, what's my muse?
Yeah, well, I'm waiting for, you know, if it's music, I need the podium. Top three bands of all time. Go.
Top three bands of all time. The Grateful Dead, Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Oh my God, I'm right with you. I'm right there. Can I tell you a funny story? Years ago, my family had a restaurant and hotel on the Western Slope. So think Crested Butte, Colorado, that area there. And, you know, my parents are European. And I was away at college, and a buddy of mine who apprenticed at the Broadmoor was running the kitchen of our restaurant.
With Ziggy. That was when
Ziggy. Yeah. My dad introduced me to Ziggy. Oh my God. God, I love this conversation.
I could tell you a crazy story, but I won't.
So my kids are going to listen to this. So my mom calls. I'm at the University of Oregon going to school. I might have been a sophomore, whatever. And I call and I'm like, how's it going? And it's like, well, you know, Keith's not here. You know, Keith's the chef, right? And I'm like, well, where's Keith? You know, summer, it's busy, right? He's like, he went to go see some dead people in Telluride. Like, I know
great
exactly.
Show.
Great show.
Ziggy was a little upset. I literally flew up there when we were opening the casino at the Beau Rivage. I flew up there, and my good friend Peter Schindler was the executive chef of the Penrose Room.
Okay.
And two other apprentices were his sous chefs under him. And then it was all Europeans that he had brought over. And he was from Ireland and through Peter Timmons and whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And I went over there and I was like, Peter, I want your whole team. We're moving the whole team to Biloxi, Mississippi. And he's like, really? And I said, yeah, we're hiring everybody. So we hired everybody. They had to shut the Penrose Room down for a couple months. Ziggy got on a plane and flew down to Mississippi and was and had gone after our executive chef. He's like, what are you guys stealing my
Oh my God, the memory. When's the book coming out? Are you writing it? I mean, come on.
If I learned how to write, that'd be the number one piece. I'd probably start with just dictation, maybe a podcast. It's a little easier.
I love it. It's so many great stories. If you had to just share one nugget of knowledge for those who listen to your words and, you know, they're trying to envision their path, their journey, what are you going to tell them?
I wish it was an original, but I will steal it because I think all great things have been reworked a few times. But in the late great words of Peter Timmons, be aggressive in your own rescue. You control your destiny. You're the one that needs to push yourself. Be smart, be productive, be professional, be respectful, and be genuine and be humble. And listen, I've done some dumb in my life and I have pissed off some people and I don't do it intentionally. I move at a certain speed and pace it was the way that I was taught. It was the way that I was trained. But you don't need to learn to be, you can respect is you can give it for free. It doesn't cost us is my point. These things aren't something that you have to go out and buy. Just be humble. Tell people that they're doing a good job. Tell another chef, hey, awesome dish. Do you mind if I steal it? I do that all the time. I'm like, oh, I love that idea. I'm going to steal it. I do it with Bo. There's stuff on Bo's menu that I'm like, huh, I wonder where you got that. And then there's stuff I call him and I'm like, hey, listen, give me that recipe to that smoked peanut relish. because I had it on a dish that you made and I ate like 9 spoonfuls of it. It's amazing. And I think as chefs, when you were able to open up and just be honest and just be outright truthful and sincere, it elevates you in a world that you're able to operate that a lot of people find to be timid, or they find to be weird, and they find to be like, oh gosh, this is kind of, I told him it was a good dish and he's another chef. Yeah.
It's okay.
A great dish.
It's okay. A dish. It's a great dish. Tell High me. Five. Yeah.
Tell me you're going to steal it and run it as a special next week.
And then post it on social media. Yeah.
It's all about the execution and the technique. That's 100%. The difference.
100%.
And if you do not have the basics and you do not have the foundation, you could steal as much in the world as you want, but you can't execute it. So be smart. Learn the technique. Learn where it comes from. Learn where it came from. The definition of the dish. Peter used to, God, the stories he would tell about dishes. And I was like, he was like a walking journal. Yeah. And he would recite. He would tell you, no, page 36 in LaRousse Gastermaker he carried a Repertoire de la Cuisine around.
That's
the best book. And he was like, page 30, chef, look it up. You should understand. And he would just motivate you in weird ways.
I love it. I love it.
Speaking of food, the name of the podcast is The Ultimate Dish. We're going to leave our conversation after you tell me what the ultimate dish is. Could be anything. Could be a memory. It could be something you stole from Peter or Bo.
The ultimate dish that I've eaten, or the ultimate dish that I would want to create?
Let's do both.
Well, the ultimate dish that I had one time was in the tavern room at the Greenbrier, and Peter Schindler was the chef there. And we used to make this, it was smoked salmon, vanilla risotto with fresh English peas, a little droplet of like Spanish sherry vinegar in there. I don't know. Just at the time in my life, it just was kind of like that popping, like, holy, wow.
Would you say that if there was a stacked ranking for all chefs' favorite dish, where would risotto just in general land? It would be on the
probably
podium.
Probably the top 5, because, in your mind, you're thinking of execution and food cost.
Yeah. All right. What's the ultimate dish that you're going to create?
The ultimate dish that I'm going to create is a dish that we've raised. It is our 100% Tajimi Wagyu beef Denver steak. And Denver steak, not a lot of people using Denver steaks. I've been using them this last year, and everything that I do, again, it's just exploration of a different cut on an animal that reigns supreme in the world of taste, flavor, and marbling and tenderness. So, with the Wagyu beef, you can use a lot of different cuts. And so it's the Denver steak, simply grilled, grilled with salt.
Little pepper, maybe olive oil or not. Yeah.
I like African olive oil. So yeah, just that simple. No sauce, no nothing. Just good food.
I just love it. Chef James Porter, thank you for an exhilarating 120 mile an hour chat today. I just really, really enjoyed it. So proud of you. And I'm happy we were able to reconnect, even though the years had been between us. But, best of luck. And if I can talk my wife into it, we'll be down to see you.
We're gonna work together. That's how we do these things.
That's how you do it.
You're gonna come and be a guest chef for the weekend, and that's how we tie this in.
That's how we do it. I love it. Brilliant.
I love it.
Thanks so much, buddy. Thanks for being here. And thank you for listening to the Ultimate Dish Podcast, brought to you by Auguste Escoffier School of Culinary Arts. Visit escoffier.edu/podcast, where you'll find any materials mentioned during the podcast, including notes, links, and other resources. You can also browse other episodes and subscribe.